Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to Pro Wrestling Interviews, another blockbuster show. We are so excited to be with the friends, fans, and everybody at WLSC AM and FM in Laura, South Carolina, and Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. So glad to have all of you with us. Tonight, our panel includes Todd Saxon from Pop Culture Stars. It includes Malcolm Wildman, the Ultimate Fan. It includes Professor Wrestling, Steve Logan. And our host for the evening, who will introduce our guest, the one and only Channel 2 himself, Adam Helms. How are you doing tonight, Adam?
I am doing absolutely amazing, and first off, we want to send our love out to the amazing Velvet, who's a little under the weather tonight, so he asked me to step in tonight, and what an honor to step in with a man that I've had the privilege to know for the past few years. He's gone by many names, the doctor, the governor, and the killer. He probably can tell you a little bit more. Ladies and gentlemen, I want to welcome you to meet Mr. Michael Devine. How you doing tonight, sir?
I am simply divine.
I love it. I love it. Oh, man, it's a great night to have a chance to sit and talk with you. You know, we got a great panel that the questions are geared up with them. And so let's just talk with me and you, just talk a little bit about what's going on. Where did Michael Devine where did it all begin at? Did you grow up as a wrestling fan? Tell me where it all started.
I grew up as a wrestling fan. My grandmother and I used to watch wrestling. She lived in Spartanburg, South Carolina, God rest her soul. So we watched Mid-Atlantic, we watched wrestling coming out of Asheville. So every Saturday when I would be up there to see her, we'd watch wrestling. And I would sit there as a little boy going, wow, that's what I want to do. And over the years, I watched wrestling and got older. That bug never shook, never left. And in 1989, I was finally able to live the dream. But yeah, I was always a wrestling fan. Watched it with my grandmother. And good memories of that.
So I take it the memories that you had is something that still drives you even to this day, because you're still stepping in the ring and perfecting your craft right now.
Still stepping in the ring, yes. Still, I mean, because, the ones, like I tell the guys that are trained, wrestling, when you become a professional wrestler, it's not a hobby. It is your life. It is your lifestyle. It's what you live, breathe, and that's what I do. I mean, when I wake up in the morning with aches and pains of the body and I know where they come from, I'm thinking wrestling. I'm driving back and forth places. I do promos in the head. If I got a booking coming up, I'm doing promos on the booking of who I'm going to wrestle. I'm thinking about stuff, what I'm going to do with my trainees. So for me, wrestling is it's life. It's a life. When I had my stroke back in 2017, recovering from that, the thing that helped me recover was I said, I'm getting back in the ring. Wrestling is, for me, is not a hobby. It's a life. It's a life. It's life. That's all I can say. It's life. You know,
but before you became this great teacher that everyone's able to sit under the learning tree and learn from you, everyone starts off as someone that didn't know a lot. So tell us about how it was in the beginning when you started training to get in the wrestling business.
Well, first thing back in the 80s, late 80s, mid to late 80s, it was not easy to find a wrestling school. I remember to this day, I was up around Spring Valley in Columbus, South Carolina, where I live, and went into a little convenience store, and I saw a poster, a little sign that said, you want to be a professional wrestler? Call RJ the American. And I wrote down the number and called. And And I was like trying to get into the mafia because when he answered the phone, he was like, "Hey, who is this?" And I told him, and he said, "How'd you get this number? Tell him where I got it from." Set up a meeting. I met him, and he was training out of Moolah School, so I met there with him. And I am what, 18 at the time, so hit me with the price of training and all that, which of course, for 18-year-old was like, "What are you crazy? I don't have $1,500 to do this." But yeah, I didn't. But it wasn't until it was, you know, when I turned 21 when I finally got in. And yeah, it was. I didn't know anything, but my thing was this. I was willing and wanting to learn. It was, and I was trained by Johnny Z, and I'm gonna tell you, the training facility that Johnny Z had was a concrete garage. When I mean concrete, there were no doors and no windows. It was concrete. If you know anything about concrete, when it gets hot, it keeps the heat. When it gets cold, it keeps the cold. I was working in an oven in the summertime, and a refrigerator, and a freezer in the winter. But it was Johnny Z, Tommy Landale, and the late Southern Patriot Sammy Morton. Those three gentlemen did my initial training, and you know, and I've always been the type of person that, even you know, when you're training me and showing me something, even if I know something about it, I am listening to you. And so Johnny and Tommy and Sammy, they took me through my paces. It was cool. It was tough. But I listened to what they had to tell me. They gave me good information. They took me on the road with them. And, again, I'm a good person to sit and listen. And believe it or not, Adam, you will probably be shocked to hear this, but I am rather shy. So if I don't know people, I will sit and just be quiet and listen. That's what I did in a lot of locker rooms. If Johnny and Tommy were talking to other people, I would just sit and listen, and which is the best thing to do. You're going to sit and listen. That's how you learn. And then I think a year with them on the road and doing stuff with them, they started going back to work with Moolah, who had her own promotion. And they were like, "Well, we want to take you to Moolah." And it was Moolah that did the finishing touch of everything that I've learned. And that was an experience because it was Moolah and Mae Young. And those were some tough old ladies. And I learned a lot from them. And again, from listening and being on shows with them and just being around. And again, I'm just a listener. There wasn't too many people that I went to and said, "Show me how to do this." I just sat, listened. If I saw something that I wanted to try, I would work it out. There wasn't anybody like I do with a lot of guys like you see me do, Adam. There wasn't anybody that came to me and said, "Hey, let me come and sit under here and let me tell you something." It was a lot of that was just me sitting and listening, watching and observing, being friends with some of the guys, and, you know, traveling with Johnny and Tommy and Sammy and other guys that I knew. So that's how I got. That's where the learning tree began for me. You know, it wasn't just one particular person. There wasn't anybody that just put the arm around me. It was just being there, listening, watching. You know, they say when you want to learn, close your mouth, open your ears. That's what I did.
Exactly. Before you got into wrestling, did you have a sports background? Did you play any football or anything in high school or anything around that time?
I was a football player. My father played football. My father actually had opportunity to play for the Pittsburgh Steelers, and he blew out his knee. But he was also a wrestler as well. So I grew up under a football. My father was a football coach for the Augusta Eagles in Augusta, Georgia. So I played football, Pop Warner, and I played football in high school. So my thing was that wrestling was the thing for me. There was no, my high school in Columbia, South Carolina had no wrestling team. So I was not a part of any wrestling team. So football was the only thing that was close to wrestling because you could hit folk and all that. You can do some of the stuff you did in wrestling. But yeah, I was, and I'm still a big football fan. I don't play, but I'm a big football fan. New Orleans Saints, who that?
Do you think having that football background and being a team player and working under a coach and everything actually helped you when you got into the wrestling business with the physicality and the toughness? Do you think it helped you?
For me, to a degree, I think it helped a little bit. I've always been, like I said before, I've always been the type of learner, and this was even in school. If you're teaching me something, I'm not talking. My mouth is closed. My ears are open. And if I have a question, raise my hand. So the toughness, because believe it or not, there's nothing in football that's going to prepare you for wrestling training. Nothing. You just got to be tough. Because there's nothing in football that, you know, you don't take bumps like you do in football. There's nothing in football that's going to get your brain ready for getting in there, because wrestling, the cardio training is going to be different. The way you move is going to be different. So there's nothing in football, basketball, any of that you do. It'll get you ready for that. You just have to want it bad enough, and I wanted it bad enough. I mean, when I took my first when my training started with Johnny and Tommy, and I was in a class of three, yeah, it was grueling on the body, but when I went home, I was like, yeah, I'm gonna do this. And particularly when you're spending your money, you're not gonna just I was hitting Johnny with at the time of like $200 a week. So, yeah, I'm giving a $200. Unless my neck gets broke, I'm not quitting for no little bit of pain and discomfort. So, for me, the football and that really didn't have as much to do with preparing me for wrestling other than just my straight-up desire to do it and be a professional wrestler.
Very nice. Very nice. So, as the years went on, you've had the great opportunity to wrestle in many different organizations and everything. Tell us the way that you got around and everything. And some people that influenced you over the years, did you have that special person in your ear later on that just like, hey kid, you're doing good. I know you said that you would shut your mouth and open your ears, but is there anyone that really got you motivated, got you really excited to know, yes, I'm doing good at this? Or were you your own self-motivator?
I was pretty much my own self-motivator because when I started, again, there weren't many African-American wrestlers training. So I did not, and on most shows, I was probably going to be the only African-American wrestler on that. So there were no African-American wrestlers coming to me or anything like that. I'm trying to think. I've wrestled for a few promoters who liked the stuff that I did. But believe it or not, oddly enough, the ones that have, and I think I know what you're asking me, the ones that really kept me going and the ones that I turned to find out how I'm doing were either my tag team partners, other wrestlers, and there's very few of my, I've had many tag team partners, and I've been with many guys in the ring. So there are a handful who I can turn to and say, hey, how did I do? And they know that they're going to, and I know when they give me the answer. It's going to be legitimate. One of those is Bob Keller, who was my longtime tag team partner and manager. when I met him, he'd moved to South Carolina from West Virginia. Wrestled against each other, became tag team partners. So he has a great wrestling mind, and we used to travel. If you're talking about traveling, it was on the road. You get on the road, you drive your car. There were many a times, because my career stayed in South Carolina for the first 10 years. So from Columbia to Greenville to Spartanburg to Charleston, to all that stuff, I get in the car, I drive, you know, you ride with somebody, you're telling stories in the car. The first time that I went on a show with Johnny and Tommy, we went to Brevard, North Carolina. They drove, I'm in the back. Johnny has this thing about hitting roadkill in the car. You know, of course, you hit roadkill, you're going to get the dead animal smell in the car. So he would do that. You know, Johnny Z is a good river, so trust me. So you would do that. But that Brevard show, I got a bottle of Mad Dog 2020 orange and a big old jug of orange juice. And so we're drinking Mad Dog 2020 and orange juice on the Brevard, North Carolina. By the time we got to the show there, we were feeling no pain. you did a lot of talking. You talked about what you were doing that night, and that was pretty much it. But like I said, I was talking about guys. Now obviously Johnny and Tommy and Sammy Morton gave me good advice as being my trainers, and I did turn to them a lot because a lot of shows I were on were with them, and I tagged up with Sammy Morton. I've been in so many tag teams, but Sammy and I were the rule breakers, which was very interesting because Sammy Morton's gimmick was a Southern Patriot, so he has on the Confederate coat and everything like that. And I magnificent Michael Martel at the time, and I'm wearing a feather boa and everything. So we were interesting tag teams that the fans hated, but he was good. He was also a good referee, and he was very good. Bob Keller, one of my tag team partners I would go to for advice or who would give me critiques or if I had a question. Another tag team partner I had, L.A. Tank. Matter of fact, after my physical therapist said that it would probably be good for me to get back in the ring, the first person I called was L.A. Tank. I said, I'm coming back to South Carolina. He was wrestling down there in Charleston, and so I got in the ring with him a little bit. By the time all this happened, Moolah had already died. However, I'd also had the fortune of meeting Susan Tex Green. So I went back to Columbia and got in Susan's ring with her. And Susan, actually, when I worked out with her in her ring, she was like, yeah, I think you're going to be all right.
Taking a bump in that ring will definitely wake you up.
Oh, yeah, it'll wake you up. It will definitely wake you up. I was not that concerned about bumping in the ring because I bumped in that ring before. My concern was because my left side was affected. I was more concerned about my balance and ability to move in the ring and what I would need to modify as I moved in the ring because I'm also older, too. I mean, at that point, I'm 51 years old. So the body's already going, hey, you know, you had a stroke and, you know, you're still trying to do this? You sure you want to do this? And once the body got into the ring, the body said, yeah, we can do this. But yeah, it's fun being on the road, like I was talking about, because you're talking to whoever you're traveling with. I've traveled with Bob and a group of guys, and I mean, I've traveled with, God, so many people. And, you know, you're doing ribs, and you're talking, and you're telling stories, and you're telling jokes, and you're aggravating other folk on the road. I'm a big fan of Blazing Saddle, and I'll never forget, a group of us were going to Pennsylvania for a show up there. I'm in the passenger seat. I think it was Bob's van. He had a conversion van. And we rolled by a carload of some very attractive white women. So, of course, me, Blazing Saddles, Bob's looking at me, and I don't know what he's thinking. So I roll the window down, and I say, hey, where's all the white women at? And, of course, they do watch Blazing Saddles. You know where that line comes from. So you do all that stuff, and then you go to the show, and you work the event, and afterwards you're somewhere eating, and you're carrying on. I'm sure Bob, there was a time we were coming back from the through the mountains, and Bob and I, the one thing about me, I do not like heights, and I do not like mountains. Every time we would leave from Columbia, South Carolina, we'd ride together to go to Martinsburg, Virginia, somewhere up there. By the time we would get the Fancy Gap, I'm asleep. Because, and Bob would say, and Bob would be, and we would go through the mountains, I'm sound asleep. As soon as we get out of the mountains, I'm awake, and Bob would put up a conversation. I'm like, what's happening? He's like, yeah, you know. So, you know, it's the travel. It was, and I think that helped me a lot, too, because as you're traveling those long miles, you're talking about your match, the match you may have, and because most of the time you didn't know you were going to wrestle if you're going to another state. You don't know these people. I was booked on a show in Pennsylvania that first time where for some reason the promoter thought I was 7 feet tall. So they got me booked with a guy who's 7 foot something, and I'm like 6 foot three. So I get there, and this guy's like, where's Muhammad Kane? That's the name we're working under. And I'm like, I'm right here. He said, well, I thought you were a giant. I said, I don't know who told you that, but I didn't get the booking. Somebody booked me on there. I said, put me in there with this giant, and we're going to get it done. And the giant couldn't wrestle. He couldn't. It was horrible. But we got through. But that was where I met the person who would make a big influence on my life, a lady by the name of Karen Deep. She was the vice president of the organization. We became friends. She became my business manager and my best friend in the world. I got to mentor her family. Her kids are my kids. And that was one person who I definitely, when you talk about learning tricks, because she was a professional wrestler too. So basically, when it came to business stuff, when I had questions about things or something I didn't want to do, or if it was a booking that I did not want, let me tell you this story. So by this time, I'm wrestling a lot, and there's a promotion in Elizabeth City, North Carolina. This guy wanted me to work for him, and I'm like, I don't want to go to Elizabeth City. So I told Karen, I said, look, I told this dude needs to contact you, so he's going to contact you. Give him a booking fee amount that will be out of the pocket. Now, again, this is like early 90, like 90, 91, somewhere in there. So she gave him a booking fee of like $125, something like that. And I'm sure he's not going to take that. So she calls me. She says, Mike. I said, yes. So I got a question for you. I said, what's the question? I talked to the guy, David Duncan. Yeah. What did he say? Well, he said he wants to book you. I said, are you kidding me? $125? He's going to pay me $125? She said, yeah. I said, tell him I need half the money up front before I go. I knew that would kill it. I got half the money in the mail. I said, son of a bitch. Okay. So I made the trip up there. I worked for him for a little bit. I worked for like four shows. And, of course, Adam Helms, anybody that knows me, if you sit down and talk to me about wrestling, I'm going to give you my experiences and stuff and ideas. You like the ideas I had? Next thing I know, he wants me to be his booker. I'm like, no, I'm not going to be this man's booker. I'm not going to be committed to this organization like that. No. So I said, look, call my agent, call Karen, and y'all work it out. I told Karen, I said, Karen, I do not want to be this man's booker. Understand this, Karen. Give this dude a price. Tell him for me to wrestle and book, I need $200. Now, I know $200 is going to knock this out of the park. I knew it. I'm just like, $200, done. She called him. She says, Mike. I said, yes. She said, are you really sure that he doesn't go for $200? Karen, if that man's not going to go for it, she said, well, guess what? You're wrong. He said, he will pay you $200. I said, what? I said, same deal. Pay me half up. What? She said, he'll pay you. He will send half to you and give you the half when you get there. So I ended up booking for him, and $200 for like a year and a half working for him. So, yeah, sometimes you can do everything you can and book yourself and still get booked. But, yeah, she was a wonder. God rest her soul. She was one. the guys in the Gorilla Squad, Ali Steele's another guy who I turned to. I've had a lot of people who were not, who were my peers or who were younger than me, who gave me, who helped me see what I was doing, who gave me the critiques that I needed and gave it to me straight. Because one thing about me, if I come to you and say, hey, how did that look? If you know that was great, that was wonderful. Okay. I don't think it was that great. So like I said, Bob Keller, Karen Dietz, Ali Steele, you know, the L.A. Tank, those guys, they'll tell me straight off the muscle, no, Mike, you know, you could have done this a little better, or, you know, maybe you should have done this a little bit better. And I think with that and just the way that I am, and like you mentioned me giving, you know, advice and stuff, that's what made me become a pretty good trainer, I think. I've trained a few guys, and I've given guys some advice and stuff just because I want to see everybody live their dream. But I'm also the one who is going to tell you, if you are garbage, you're garbage. And everybody has a dream of doing something. But just because you have that dream, and I know I don't like being a dream smasher, but sometimes every dream you have cannot come
true. Someone's got to tell you.
Someone's got to tell you. Because if you get into this business, particularly wrestling, with the dream, but you don't have the aptitude, the ability, you can hurt yourself. You can hurt and kill somebody else. And so somebody's got to tell you, no, this is, I know this is your dream, but this dream, you're not ready for this dream. You need to let it go. It's hard to tell somebody that, but it's the truth.
It really is. Someone has to. And just from that answer, it kind of segued into two other things I wanted to talk about. I wanted to talk to you about the Gorilla Squad. But there's one other thing I want to bring up first. Can you tell me who the pretty boy psycho is?
The pretty boy psycho is my boy, A.C. Divine. And let me tell you about A.C. Divine. He is 6'4". He is 200 pounds of a machine. And I'm going to tell you what. Just like his father, he can do it all, but he has one thing that will leave everybody's head rattling. It's called the COD, Concussion on Demand. It is a superpowered boot to your head, a boot to your face that will lay you out, knock you out, and leave you babbling and crying for your mama. That's my son, my boy, in whom I'm so pleased. He's my baby boy. But I have two other sons.
Go ahead. When I heard that you were coming on the show tonight, that was the one question I was going to ask you. And then when I was asked to host it, I was like, I got to bring it in because we've had discussions about your son before, and now, you know, he's finally in the business. And I know you can't be more proud of anything in the world right now. Did you actually train him or, you know?
I trained him. As a matter of fact, he started training at 16, 17, he started training. And I'm going to tell you, at first I was like, okay, this kid, I don't know. But like me, he did not quit. He was dedicated to doing this. AC is a cancer survivor. And it was his dream. So I was like, well, you know what, if this is your dream, I'm gonna see you get your dream through. And it was tough. As it always is in wrestling, you know, he learned and he went through and he went through and he went through. So he got it. So he had his first match against me. And
that was my next
good.
Question.
Yeah, he had his first match, matter of fact, under a mask. At his first match, and when he had his first match, I was like, yeah, I think he's gonna do it. He recently had his, because when COVID hit, he was basically done with training. So he was just getting booking. So by the COVID hit and shut everything down. I want to say 3 weeks ago, he had his first match in a promotion that was not the one that was from the training school, with Shockwave. And I was so proud of him. He delivered that COD. Every fan, every guy in the locker room that was watching the monitors flew their top, because when my son hit that COD, he did a split too. He knocked that monkey's head off his shoulders. He did a split. Everybody was like, I can't believe he did it. I said, you better believe it, because his last name is Divine, and it's so fine when you are Divine.
Well, let's ask the question that's going to be on the table. One, will we see the Pretty Boy Psycho become part of the Gorilla Squad? And did the old gray gorilla teach him everything that he knows yet?
Well, about now, let's see. Well, I'm going to tell you what. I've talked to Ali Steele, and Ali Steele, Uncle Ali, as Ali calls, says that's my nephew. And I will say this, like I got the finishing with the Fabulous Moolah, AC will get the finishing with the Gorilla Squad. He will. Ali has said to me, he said, I want to take him under my wing and show him some more stuff. I said, well, go ahead on, brother, because I can't always be there, and the squad is going to take care of my boy. So will he be a gorilla? Yeah, he'll be a gorilla. He'll be a gorilla. There will always be a Divine in the Gorilla Squad, because as we all know, I'm getting older, and my talent might be best served as doing what I used to do a little bit before, which is being a manager and being the engineer that controls the train. You know, so yeah, don't be surprised if it's another Divine in the ring with the Gorilla Squad. And the mastermind is outside the ring, making sure everything goes down. And did I teach him everything? I'm gonna tell you what. I taught him what he needed to know, because he is his own man. He has the heart. But now, if he wrestles the old great gorilla, the killer, the governor, the doctor, yeah, we've had a few sparring matches. When we work out, when we do our trainings, we do matches, and we go at it. When I taught him, when I showed him how to do the boot, which I probably shouldn't have done, and he hit me with it, because he used to do it out of the corner. He would throw you in the thing. He did a headbutt, a leg drop, and what he would do is he'd throw you into the corner, give you the boot, boom. The leg drop on you, boom, it was over. He had big legs. He hit me with that boot one time in the corner. And I said, oh, my God, I think I'm going to die. I think I had another stroke. He gave me a leg drop one time, and I said, oh, my God, I'm going to die. This I'm going to be destroyed. He doesn't have my mind yet, because he's navigating. But that night when I watched him wrestle in a tag team match with a guy he did not know, he tagged up with Rock Richards. He did the damn thing. So when he gets, because he's 19 now, he's going to grow into his body. He's going to grow into this business. And I guarantee you, and when he gets more size on him and he gets more experience on him, yeah, y'all better watch out. Yeah, I'm going to give the whole business to him. Y'all look. I'm gonna let y'all ask for it. Y'all got it now. You're in trouble. It's not over. It's divine too. The divine dynasty continues to grow. Yeah.
There you go. That's so great to hear. It's around that time, you know, that we're going to open the panel for questions. I actually had someone text me some questions. He can't actually ask them, but Steve Logan is listening, so he had a few questions he wanted me to ask.
No,
you're on? Okay, well, why don't you go ahead and ask the questions you were going to ask. I'm sorry. Go right ahead, bud.
Yeah. You mentioned teaming up with LA Tank. How did DRS Inc. get started?
DRS Inc. Oh, my God. Well, you know what? It actually started in Elizabeth City, but it didn't start with me. What happened, LA Tank had another tag team partner, late, great Tannonball Jones. They were the Elite. And then I worked them in some matches. I started working up there. How we became Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, DRS Inc., Tank started working in UPWA, and he wanted to bring me down. And I was like, well, okay, I'll work for another promotion. So, and he wanted to tag up, and he and I had not really tagged up regularly. So we went down, we had a first tag team match together, and me and Tank are unique. To the degree that Tank is a wild card, and I'm the one trying to control this Tank. We would do some dastardly things. A lot of stuff was mind games. So we got to start like that. We did some things. We were the tag team champions down there, I think. 3 times, I took the heavyweight title off of him at his. He wanted me to wrestle him for this belt that he had, the heavyweight title he had for like a year, and the promoter was like, "Well, who do you want to wrestle for the belt?" I want to wrestle Mike Devine, and I'm like, "What? What? Wrestle me? Because you do realize, just because we boys, I'm gonna go to that ass. You do know that, don't you?" He's like, "Yeah, I want to. I won't." That's what I want. I want to see if I can do it. And, yeah, so we went at it. Matter of fact, I was a part of the squad at the time. So the squad was ringside. And we were cool with Tank, so we weren't going to jump on him. But I was like, yeah, whoop that ass. And and won the title. But yeah, that's how the Scoundrels started. We had a good run down there at UPWA. We were popular with the fans, but we didn't wrestle as faces, per se. We were real quick to, nutshot and eye poke. But the thing about us, like the same thing with the Gorilla Squad, we were real. We came out to whoop that ass. We didn't really care, if you were across that ring from us and you thought you was going to get a night off or something. No. Dude, you're going to whoop your ass. That's it. We're going to beat you up. And if you can't handle that, you might want to get out the ring right now while you got a chance. Because you're going to leave limping. You're going to leave limping, hurting. We're going to get a big check, but you're going to be in trouble. That's it. Yeah.
I wanted to ask also, use the Iron Claw hold as a finisher sometimes. What led you to using the Iron Claw as a finisher?
Because, you know what? Growing up watching wrestling, Dan Von Reschke was a wrestler I watched, and Blackjack Mulligan. And when you saw, they had big hands, and I was just, and so in my wrestling career, I've used different finishers, but I was a lot, and anyone can tell you that a lot of my stuff that I come up with from gimmick names or whatever comes from working out and training. I was training with somebody, and I put the claw on him, and I realized I got big hands, and they're strong. And I realized that my thumb, because of the size of my hand, my thumb and my pinky finger can hit the temple real good with the three other fingers supporting the top of the head and the other hand behind the head. And he was like, you're hurting me. I said, where you feel the pain at? In my temple. Good. So I started using the claw. Not only that, so I went back to using it because a lot of people aren't using the claw. Everybody wants to use some spectacular maneuver, some high flying, something impact. No. A claw, you snatch it on, you grab control, or you're going to tap out, because when I start squeezing, when they start going into the temple, yeah, you're going to tap out. Look, remember when you were little and your dad was grabbing your head and do the claw on you when you were a little kid? And that's just that stuff hurt. So that's what I do. So I love the claw. It's old school. The only modification I did to it one time was I used to do let me say it on the record right now, before Eric the Red or whatever his name is now, the one that was with Bray Wyatt's thing, the red-headed dude, before he started doing his choke slam claw, I was doing that first. The iron claw that he did, I was doing that first. I would put the claw on them, grab them by their trunks, bring them up, slam them down, boom, 1, 2, 3. But, yeah, the iron claw is a throwback to old school. It's an old school hold, and it works. I started to call it the stroke after I had my stroke because, you know, it works on the brain. But I figured that might be, you know, I figured, darn, the claw. Let's do it, the claw. The claw.
Yeah, I'd love to see you versus Lance Archer. He does a version of the claw, too, that turns into a pin like you've been. One last question I wanted to ask, can you explain some of your alter egos? Like, you went by Atomic Dog and Muhammad Kane and Big Daddy Kane. Can you explain those alter egos?
Okay. I'm going to try to keep it short because I know you got to do it in another hour. Okay. Understand that back in the early days of wrestling, there was no internet. Okay. So I would have bookings in different places. And a lot of promoters would give me a gimmick. Like, one gimmick I had, Big Daddy Kane. At the time when I became Big Daddy Kane, I was actually working as Magnificent Michael Martel. A promoter saw me on a show, and he had a guy, at the time, Dion Black Tech Johnson was working as the Stone Cold Kid. So he was bringing me in, and he was like, look, I want you to handle this Stone Cold Kid. So I said, cool. So instead of me being Magnificent Michael, I put on a suit like Mr. Hughes and became Big Daddy Kane. Big Daddy Kane was basically your bodyguard, bruiser, brawler. I whoop that ass, I break that neck. I'm here to get that check. That's what I'm here to do. So I'm doing Big Daddy Kane up around Greenville. Well, I started working for a guy, Preston Leaphart, down in Columbia, South Carolina, for Southeastern Championship Wrestling, and he was running. So he wanted me to work down there for him. And I said, well, I can't. Well, I don't want to be Big Daddy Kane down here because he wanted me to be, because I was going to be a face. I said, okay. And so I bought a red, white, and blue singlet. And I'm like, I got to come up with a name. Well, I'm a fan of Rocky. And I'm a fan of Apollo Creed. So I became Apollo Kane. So I became Apollo Kane. Now, how I became Atomic Dog, again. Now, I'm still working as Big Daddy Kane and Greenville and Greer. I'm still Apollo Kane, but I'm still Magnificent. I went to Magnificent Michael Martel, the Divine, down in Georgia. Then I'm Muhammad Kane at this point in Pennsylvania and West Virginia. So I'm on a show in Wagner, South Carolina, and I'm supposed to work a match with Junkyard Dog in Georgia. Me and Dog are on the same show in Wagner. We're in the locker room with towels over our head talking. Somebody comes in and says, hey, Dog, you're up next. So we're still talking. And this person says, dog, you're up next. We're not paying attention. So the guy taps my leg, and I pull the towel down to wet. Oh, my bad. I thought you were jumping out dog. No, they're sitting next door, next to me. So dog pulls it down, and we're getting ready to go. So when dog comes back, he's like, well, hey, brother, are we on a show in Georgia? Yeah, we're working each other. He said, well, look, that dude thought you were me. I said, yeah, I noticed that. He said, well, if I get the promoter to switch it up, would you like to be my tag team partner? Well, hell, man, you ain't said nothing hot to a fire. I mean, this is Junkyard Dog. I said, yeah. So the promoter called me and said, hey, Junkyard Dog wants to be his tag team partner. What can you do? I said, I can do that. So I contact Ken Timms and Juanita Timms in Georgia. I get, because, you know, Dog was wearing red and white, I believe, at the time. So I got red, blue trunks, red long tights, because my dad and my mother went to South Carolina State. They were South Carolina State Bulldogs. That's where they went to college. So I said, and at first I was going to be the Bulldog. But I was like, you know what? Junkyard Dog, and I'm a fan of George Clinton, Atomic Dog. So I became
the dog.
I became
dog.
There you go. Dog catch came out to that. So that's how I became Atomic Dog. Over the years, because I got a creative mind, and again, I mean, there's been other things. I've been working out and rest training guys. Because when I'm training guys, I try to do matches with them and help them set up gimmicks and ideas for stuff. So for a little while, I was also Studley Bo Hunk. You know, I am Studley Bo Hunk. See my muscles? I've been Muhammad Kane, just run down real quick. Muhammad Kane was a militant, angry black guy who just wanted to beat up everybody, but his stable was all white guys. Go figure. Of course, I told you about Atomic Dog, Apollo Kane. Apollo Kane was your red, white, and blue superhero, all-American babyface. We all talked about Big Daddy Kane. Magnificent Michael Martel, actually, when I started working for Moolah, I had pitched her the gimmick of Marvelous Magnificent Michael Hollywood. She was like, well, that's too long. So when they gave me the gimmick, they shortened it down to Magnificent Michael, and it was a gay gimmick, and it was supposed to be a face. And so I had my first debut match as Magnificent Michael in Orangeburg, South Carolina, wearing pink and a boa in front of a black crowd, so you can imagine how that went over. But I was Magnificent Michael for a long time. I'm a fan of Sherry Martel and Rick Martel. And I felt that I needed a last name. I just did not do two L. That thing, he did one L, I did two L. So I became Magnificent Michael Martel. And eventually it became Divine, because a street that I lived on in Columbia was Divine Street, D-E-V-I-N-E. So I said, well, got the Martel, be Divine. And the only time it's changed, I've been Michael Divine except for when I moved to North Carolina, worked for Power Pro here. I had no history in North Carolina. So the promoter was like, well, they wanted to bring me in as a bodyguard, and I didn't want to be Big Daddy Kane. And they was like, well, we need to come up with a name for you. And again, I'm a fan of Baron Von Raschke. And as a kid, I would go around and remember the Baron always said, that is all the people need to know. So I did that for the promoter, and he was like, so what are you going to call yourself? I am Hess, H-E-S-S, was the only thing that sounded German to me. So I'm the German Destroyer Hess, a big black man wearing a suit and a tie, and I did use the claw for that. But other than that, I became Michael Divine, and that's been it. So all the names and personas have just been, you know, I got multiple personalities. Basically, you know, that's the dude that I am.
That's a way to put those voices in the head to work.
Hey, and guess what? And look, when I'm doing promos, look, I've done, you would not believe, because when I'm telling the guys how to do promos, I have done promos of Michael Devine cutting a promo on Michael Martel, cutting a promo on Big Daddy Kane, on Muhammad Kane, and I mean, it's like, and the thing is, when I get done, I'm like, do you realize how much of a psychopath you'd sound like if somebody overheard you? Because each one has a different sound in their voice. Because Big Daddy Kane didn't talk too much, but when he did, it was like, what you need to know is that I bring you pain. I'm Big Daddy Kane. That's it. He didn't do a whole lot of talking. Michael Martel and Michael Devine, Michael Martel was more like Ric Flair. Michael Martel was more like, I've got all the champagne, baby. I've got all the style and the profile. I'm smooth as chocolate on a hot summer day. You know, so, but Michael Devine is your super villain. The one thing about Michael Devine, and he will tell you that to his face, to your face, I am a snake. I am that dog. I will bite you. Now, we're going to be cool. Look, I'll tag up with you, Adam Helms, and we'll get the job done. But understand, I'm a dog now. You understand? So I'm going to bite you when it's over. And the thing is, the fans will say, like, look, don't trust Michael. He'll bite you. And then when I bite him, they're like, oh, my God. Oh, I did forget one gimmick. I was also Shaka Kalama. That was they wanted me to do a Kamala gimmick, and I was against it only because I have issues with that type of a gimmick. And I told the promoter, I said, look, I will do the gimmick in this part of your territory, because it's not territory at the time, but I won't do it over here. I'll still be Michael Martel, right? He said, yeah, you'll do that. So I'm Shaka Kalama over here with Bob as my manager and Michael Martel over here, but Shaka Kalama scared kids. And I was like, oh, my God. And even though it was a good gimmick and we could have made money with it, me personally, just had an issue with it because I was the savage African. And me, myself, like, I just don't want to be that stereotypical. But it was, I have to admit, it was because they had this music for me and the smoke, and then Bob would come out, and I'd have a towel over my head, and he'd pull it off, and I worked that gimmick. I mean, I terrorized people. They were just like, oh, my God, this is a crazy man. I enjoy this business so much that I think about all the things that I can do that just will make it, I mean, that's it in the Reader's Digest at the best that I could. That's the best that I could do.
Well, gentlemen, we got about 5 more minutes left before we're going to have to wrap everything up. Mr. Todd Saxon from Pop Culture Stars, do you have any questions for Mr. Michael Devine?
Yeah, I want to run it through the we're hearing that Michael Devine's got we know his mind's quick, he's agile, he's obviously got a twisted sense of humor. Anybody that's a Blazing Saddles fan, we've killed one DVD and had to get the second one here in this house on that one, just saying. So you're sitting there and you got a good sense of humor and you can deal with things. Has there been anybody that just did something that busted you up because they were so darn funny that it just fouled with your character's bearing?
Oh, my God. Oh, Jesus Christ. Yes, there have been. God, there's been this, because it's hard to crack me up, but once you get me cracked up, it's it. I'm trying to think of, there's been so many. I know Bob, there was one involving Bob Keller again. He was working, and it was more with me just being there seeing it, and so every time it popped in my head, I would laugh. He was working another guy. They were tag teams, and they put him in a situation where they had to wrestle each other in a tournament. So his partner, Red Dog, held ropes open and said, he was holding ropes open for Bob to get out. And Bob was like, what are you doing? And Red Dog was like, well, I'm letting you get out of the ring. He said, what are you doing that for? Told him to beat your ass. And Bob said without a beat, oh, I'd like to see that. And and he did the back. I'm cracking up in the back. So every time I had to work Bob, this would come into my head, and I would just be like, "What are you laughing about? I just can't get it out of my head." I was in a match with somebody who said something about making love to a midget. Had me in a headlock and scared. See, and there was a midget in the front. There was a small person. I know them. And in the front, he said, "Do you see the little midget?" Yeah, I asked her last night, and I lost it. And I was just like, "Oh my god!" And here I am. I'm supposed to be the serious brawler, and I'm in the corner like, "Oh my god! Please, brother, keep punching me because I'm gonna die."
All right.
You're welcome.
Mr. Malcolm Wildman, do you have anything for Michael Devine?
Yeah, Michael, I think you're hilarious, man. I've been laughing since I heard you the first time. I've met Carl Weathers, Apollo Creed. I met Burt Young and two other people from Rocky at these Hollywood shows. As a matter of fact, Burt Young, we were talking about that time in Rocky III, where Apollo Creed invited Rocky to retrain him out on the West Coast in L.A. And Carl Weathers were talking about. He goes, "Is he always this hard?" He goes, "Just takes a little bit of time to get to know Apollo." "I ain't got that much time." I'm looking forward to meeting you, Michael. And when I meet you, I want to talk more about stuff with you I've been through in my life, but I'd like to do one thing for you if I could, please. I don't know if you like him this much, but I'd like to do a little madness for you if I could, please.
Yeah, when you're around Michael Devine, man, it's not just the madness all around you, it's the divine madness. Oh yeah.
Okay. Oh, that was good. But may I give you mine? Because I did this.
Go for it.
I did this.
Go for it. I
did this.
Yeah.
Okay. Here we go. All right. Here we go.
Will, what are you talking about here? So you get Michael Devine on this? You got him on this show, and he's talking about all the things he do. Well, let me tell you something, brother. Yeah. In the room with the macho man, what do you know, magnificent Michael Martell? Yeah, when you get in the room with the macho man, you're going to feel the madness, and it won't be easy time.
Michael, when I meet you, I want some pictures with you, if that's all right. I really do.
It'll be an honor.
Man, what a show. Wow.
Only on Pro Wrestling Interviews where you have a madness off. Oh, man, this is absolutely great. Well, once again, thank you for our panel, for everyone. And also, thank you for Michael Devine for being such a great guest. Sir, it was always a pleasure. Always a pleasure.
I've got you for 2 minutes.
But unreal. It's just one of those things. Dr. John, if you're still on with us, please take us out.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you what, it has been a lot of fun. I always enjoy listening to Michael Devine. It was great. And thanks to our panel. It was so good having Professor Wrestling, Steve Logan, Todd Saxon, and, of course, Malcolm Wildman. So, Adam Helms, thanks a lot for emceeing tonight. We'll be back next week on our podcast and on WLSC AM and FM, Loras, South Carolina, and Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Have a good one, and we'll see you next week. This is Dr. John saying so long for tonight.